She took a sheet from her portfolio and began to sketch the rock patterns. One sketch to calm her, and then she would get back to the soulcaster. Perhaps she should try it on her other hand again. She couldn't capture the colors of the strata, not in charcoal, but she could record the fascinating way the strata wove together, like a work of art. Had some stone worker cut this ceiling intentionally, crafting this subtle creation? Or was it an accident of nature? She smiled, imagining some overworked stone cutter noticing the beautiful grain of the rock and deciding to form a wave pattern for his own personal wonder and sense of beauty.
"What are you?"
Shallan yelped, sitting up, sketchpad bouncing free of her lap. Someone had whispered those words. She'd heard them distinctly. "Who is there?" she asked. Silence. "Who's there?" she said more loudly, her heart beating quickly. Something sounded outside her door from the sitting room. Shallan jumped, hiding the hand wearing the soulcaster under a pillow as the door creaked open, revealing a wizened palace maid, dark-eyed and dressed in a white and black uniform.
"Oh, dear," the woman exclaimed. "I had no idea you were here, Brightness."
She bowed low. "A palace maid, here to clean the room, an everyday occurrence." Focused on her meditation, Shallan hadn't heard her enter.
"Why did you speak to me?" "Speak to you, Brightness?"
"You..." No, the voice had been a whisper, and it had quite distinctly come from inside Shallan's room. It couldn't have been the maid. She shivered and glanced about. But that was foolish. The tiny room was easily inspected. There were no void bringers hiding in the corners or under her bed. What then had she heard? Noises from the woman cleaning, obviously. Shallan's mind had just interpreted those random sounds as words. Forcing herself to relax, Shallan looked out past the maid into the sitting room. The woman had cleaned up the wine glass and crumbs. A broom leaned against the wall. In addition, Yasna's door was cracked open.
"Were you in Brightness Yasna's room?" Shallan demanded.
"Yes, Brightness," the woman said. "Tidying up the desk, making the bed."
"Brightness Yasna does not like people entering her room. The maids have been told not to clean in there."
The king had promised that his maids were very carefully chosen, and there had never been issues of theft. But Yasna still insisted that none enter her bedchamber. The woman paled.
"I'm sorry, Brightness. I didn't hear. I wasn't told."
"Hush, it's all right," Shallan said. "You'll want to go tell her what you've done. She always notices if her things were moved. It will be better for you if you go to her and explain."
Yes, Brightness. The woman bowed again.
"In fact," Shallan said, something occurring to her, "you should go now. No point putting it off."
The elderly maid sighed.
"Yes, of course, Brightness."
She withdrew. A few seconds later, the outside door closed and locked. Shallan leapt up, pulling off the soulcaster and stuffing it back in her safe pouch. She hurried outside, heart thumping, the strange voice forgotten as she seized the opportunity to look into Yasna's room. It was unlikely that Shallan would discover anything useful about the soulcaster, but she couldn't pass up the chance, not with the maid to blame for moving things. She felt only a glimmer of guilt for this. She'd already stolen from Yasna. Compared with that, poking through her room was nothing. The bedroom was larger than Shallan's, though it still felt cramped because of the unavoidable lack of windows. Yasna's bed, a four-poster monstrosity, took up half the space. The vanity was against the far wall, and beside it the dressing table from which Shallan had originally stolen the soulcaster. Other than a dresser, the only other thing in the room was the desk, books piled high on the left side. Shallan never got a chance to look at Yasna's notebooks. Might she, perhaps, have taken notes on the soulcaster? Shallan sat at the desk,
hurriedly pulling open the top drawer and poking through the brush pens, charcoal pencils, and sheets of paper. All were organized neatly, and the paper was blank. The bottom right drawer held ink and empty notebooks. The bottom left drawer had a small collection of reference books. That left the books on the top of the table. Yasna would have the majority of her notebooks with her as she worked. But, yes, there were still a few here. Heart fluttering, Shallan gathered up the three thin volumes and set them before her. "Notes on Urethiru," the first one declared inside. The notebook was full, it appeared, of quotes from and notations about various books Yasna had found. All spoke of this place, Urethiru. Yasna had mentioned it earlier to Kabzel. Shallan put that book aside, looking at the next, hoping for mention of the Soulcaster. This notebook was also filled to capacity, but there was no title on it. Shallan picked through, reading some entries. "The ones of ash and fire who killed like a swarm, relentless before the heralds." Noted in Masli, page 337. Corroborated by Coldwin and Hasava. "They take away the light, wherever they lurk. Skin that is burned." Kormshan, page 104. Inia, in her recordings of children's folk tales, speaks of the Voidbringers as being like a high storm, regular in their coming yet always unexpected. The word desolation is used twice in reference to their appearance. See pages 57, 59, and 64 of Tales by Hearthlight. "They changed, even as we fought them. Like shadows they were, that can transform as the flame dances. Never underestimate them because of what you first see." Purports to be a scrap collected from Talatin, a radiant of the Order of Stone Wards. The source, Guvlo's Incarnate, is generally held as reliable, though this is from a copied fragment of the Poem of the Seventh Morning, which has been lost. They went on like that. Pages and pages. Yasna had trained her in this method of note-taking. Once the notebook was filled, each item would be evaluated again for reliability and usefulness and copied to different, more specific notebooks. Frowning, Shallan looked through the final notebook. It focused on Natanatan, the unclaimed hills, and the shattered plains. It collected records of discoveries by hunters, explorers, or tradesmen searching for a river passage to new Natanatan. Of the three notebooks, the largest was the one that focused on the Voidbringers. The Voidbringers again. Many people in more rural places whispered of them and other monsters of the dark. The raspings or storm whispers, or even the dreaded nightspren. Shallan had been taught by stern tutors that these were superstitions, fabrications of the lost radiance, who used tales of monsters to justify their domination of mankind. The Ardents taught something else. They spoke of the lost radiance, called the Knights Radiant then, fighting off Voidbringers during the war to hold Roshar. According to these teachings, it was only after defeating the Voidbringers and the departure of the heralds that the radiance had fallen. Both groups agreed that the Voidbringers were gone. Fabrications or long-defeated enemies, the result was the same. Shallan could believe that some people, some scholars even, might believe that the Voidbringers still existed, haunting mankind. But Yasna the skeptic? Yasna who denied the existence of the Almighty? Could the woman really be so twisted as to deny the existence of God but accept the existence of his mythological enemies? A knock came at the outer door. Shallan jumped, raising her hand to her breast. She hurriedly replaced the notebooks on the desk in the same order and orientation. Then, flustered, she hurried out to the door. "Yasna wouldn't knock, you silly fool," she told herself, unlocking and opening the door a crack. Kabzel stood outside. The handsome, light-eyed Ardent held up a basket.
"I've heard reports that you have the day free."
He shook the basket temptingly.
"Would you like some jam?"
Shallan calmed herself, then glanced back at Yasna's open quarters. She really should investigate more. She turned to Capsule, meaning to tell him no, but his eyes were so inviting. That hint of a smile on his face, that good-natured and relaxed posture. If Shallan went with Capsule, maybe she could ask him what he knew regarding soulcasters. That wasn't what decided it for her, however. The truth was, she needed to relax. She'd been so on edge lately, brain stuffed with philosophy, every spare moment spent trying to make the soulcaster work. Was it any wonder she was hearing voices? "I'd love some jam," she declared. "Truthberry jam," Capsule said, holding up the small green jar. "It's Azish. Legends there say that those who consume the berries speak only the truth until the next sunset." Shallan raised an eyebrow. They were seated on cushions atop a blanket in the Conclave Gardens, not far from where she'd first experimented with the soulcaster.
"And is it true?"
"Hardly," Capsule said, opening the jar. "The berries are harmless, but the leaves and stalks of the truthberry plant, if burned, give off a smoke that makes people intoxicated and euphoric. It appears that people's often gathered the stalks for making fires. They'd eat the berries around the campfire and have a rather interesting night."
"It's a wonder," Shallan began, then bit her lip.
"What?" he prodded.
She sighed. "It's a wonder they didn't become known as birth berries, considering—"
She blushed.
He laughed.
"That's a good point."
"Stormfather," she said, blushing further. "I'm terrible at being proper. Here, give me some of that jam."
He smiled, handing over a slice of bread with green jam slathered across the top. A dull-eyed parchman, appropriated from inside the conclave, sat on the ground beside a shale-bark wall, acting as an impromptu chaperone. It felt so strange to be out with a man near her own age with only a single parchman in attendance. It felt liberating, exhilarating. Or maybe that was just the sunlight and the open air.
"I'm also terrible at being scholarly," she said, closing her eyes, breathing deeply. "I like it outside far too much."
"Many of the greatest scholars spent their lives traveling.
And for each one of them," Shallan said, "there were 100 more stuck back in a hole of a library buried in books."
"And they wouldn't have had it any other way.
Most people with a bent for research prefer their holes and libraries, but you do not. That makes you intriguing."
She opened her eyes, smiling at him, then took a luscious bite of her jam and bread. This Thalen bread was so fluffy it was more like cake.
"So," she said as he chewed on his bite, "do you feel any more truthful now that you've had the jam?"
"I'm an ardent," he said. "It is my duty and calling to be truthful at all times."
"Of course," she said. "I'm always truthful as well. So full of truth, in fact, that sometimes it squeezes the lies right out my lips. There isn't a place for them inside, you see."
He laughed heartily.
"Shallan Devar, I can't imagine anyone as sweet as yourself uttering a single untruth."
"Then for the sake of your sanity, I'll keep them coming in pairs," she smiled. "I'm having a terrible time and this food is awful."
"You've just disproven an entire body of lore and mythology surrounding the eating of truthberry jam."
"Good," Shallan said. "Jam should not have lore or mythology. It should be sweet, colorful, and delicious."
"Like young ladies, I presume."
"Brother Capsule," she blushed again. "That wasn't at all appropriate."
"And yet you smile."
"I can't help it," she said. "I'm sweet, colorful, and delicious."
"You have the colorful part right," he said, obviously amused at her deep blush. "And the sweet part. Can't speak for your deliciousness."
"Capsule," she exclaimed, though she wasn't entirely shocked.
She'd once told herself that he was interested in her only in order to protect her soul, but that was getting more and more difficult to believe. He stopped by at least once a week. He chuckled at her embarrassment, but that only made her blush further.
"Stop it!"
She held her hand up in front of her eyes. "My face must be the color of my hair. You shouldn't say such things. You're a man of religion."
"But still a man, Shallan."
"One who said his interest in me was only academic."
"Yes, academic," he said idly. "Involving many experiments and much first-hand field research."
"Capsule?"
He laughed deeply, taking a bite of his bread.
"I'm sorry, Brightness Shallan, but it gets such a reaction."
She grumbled, lowering her hand, but knew that he said the things, in part, because she encouraged him. She couldn't help it. Nobody had ever shown her the kind of interest that he increasingly did. She liked him, liked talking with him, liked listening to him. It was a wonderful way to break the monotony of study. There was, of course, no prospect for a union. Assuming she could protect her family, she'd be needed to make a good political marriage. Dallying with an ardent owned by the King of Carbranth wouldn't serve anyone. "I'll soon have to start hinting to him the truth," she thought. "He has to know that this won't go anywhere, doesn't he?" He leaned toward her.
"You really are what you seem, aren't you, Shallan?"
"Capable? Intelligent? Charming?" He smiled.
"Genuine."
"I wouldn't say that," she said.
"You are. I see it in you."
"It's not that I'm genuine. I'm naive. I lived my entire childhood in my family's manor."
"You don't have the air of a recluse about you. You're so at ease at conversation."
"I had to become so. I spent most of my childhood in my own company, and I detest boring conversation partners." He smiled, though his eyes held concern.
"It seems a shame that one such as you would lack for attention. That's like hanging a beautiful painting facing the wall."
She leaned back on her safe hand, finishing off her bread. "I wouldn't say I lacked for attention. Not quantitatively, for certain. My father paid me plenty of attention."
"I've heard of him. A stern man by reputation."
"He's..."
She had to pretend he was still alive.
"My father is a man of passion and virtue, just never at the same time."
"Shallan, that might just be the wittiest thing I've heard you say."
"And perhaps the most truthful, unfortunately." Capsule looked into her eyes, searching for something.
What did he see? "You don't seem to care for your father much."
"Another truthful statement. The berries are working on both of us, I see."
"He's a hurtful man, I gather."
"Yes, though never to me. I'm too precious. His ideal, perfect daughter. You see, my father is precisely the type of man to hang a picture facing the wrong way. That way it can't be soiled by unworthy eyes or touched by unworthy fingers."
"That's a shame, as you look very touchable to me."
She glared. "I told you no more of that teasing."
"That wasn't teasing," he said, regarding her with deep blue eyes, earnest eyes. "You intrigue me, Shallan Devar."
She found her heart thumping. Oddly, a panic rose within her at the same time. "I shouldn't be intriguing."
"Why not?"
"Logic puzzles are intriguing. Mathematical computations can be intriguing. Political maneuvers are intriguing. But women, they should be nothing short of baffling."
"And what if I think I'm beginning to understand you?"
"Then I'm at a severe disadvantage," she said, "as I don't understand myself."
He smiled.
"We shouldn't be talking like this, Capsule. You're an ardent."
"A man can leave the ardentia, Shallan."
She felt a jolt. He looked steadily at her, not blinking. Handsome, soft-spoken, witty. This could grow very dangerous very quickly, she thought.
Yasna thinks you're getting close to me because you want her soul caster, Shallan blurted out. Then she winced.
Idiot!
That's your response when a man hints that he might leave the service of the Almighty in order to be with you?
Brightness Yasna is quite clever, Capsule said, slicing himself another piece of bread.
Shallan blinked.
You mean she's right?
Right and wrong, Capsule said. The devotee would very, very much like to get that Fabril. I planned to ask your help eventually. But my superiors thought it was a terrible idea.
He grimaced.
They think the King of Alethkar is volatile enough that he'd march to war with Carbranth over that. Soulcasters aren't shard blades, but they can be equally important.
He shook his head, taking a bite of bread.
Elokar Kolin should be ashamed to let his sister use that Fabril, particularly so trivially. But if we were to steal it, well, the repercussions could be felt across all of Vorin Roshar.
Is that so? Shallan said, feeling sick.
He nodded.
Most people don't think about it. I didn't. Kings rule and war with shards, but their armies subsist through soulcasters. Do you have any idea the kinds of supply lines and support personnel soulcasters replace? Without them, warfare is virtually impossible. You'd need hundreds of wagons filled with food every month.
I guess that would be a problem.
She took a deep breath.
They fascinate me, these soul casters. I've always wondered what it would feel like to use one.
I as well.
So you've never used one?
He shook his head.
There aren't any in Carbranth.
Right, she thought. Of course. That's why the king needed Yasna to help his granddaughter.
Have you ever heard anyone talk about using one?
She cringed at the bold statement.
Would it make him suspicious?
He just nodded idly.
There's a secret to it, Shallan.
Really?
She asked, heart in her throat. He looked up at her, seeming conspiratorial.
It's really not that difficult.
It what?
It's true, he said. I've heard it from several Ardents. There's so much shadow and ritual surrounding soul casters. They're kept mysterious, aren't used where people can see. But the truth is, there's not much to them. You just put one on, press your hand against something, and tap a gemstone with your finger. It works that simply.
That's not how Yasna does it, she said, perhaps too defensively.
Yes, that confused me. But supposedly, if you use one long enough, you learn how to control them better.
He shook his head.
I don't like the mystery that has grown up around them. It smells too much like the mysticism of the old hierocracy. We'd better not find ourselves treading down that path again. What would it matter if people knew how simple the soulcasters are to use? The principles and gifts of the Almighty are often simple.
Shallan barely listened to that last part. Unfortunately, it seemed that Capsule was as ignorant as she. More ignorant, even. She'd tried the exact method he spoke of, and it didn't work. Perhaps the Ardents he knew were lying to protect the secret.
Anyway, Capsule said, I guess that's a tangent. You asked me about stealing the soulcaster, and rest assured I wouldn't put you in that position. I was foolish to think of it, and I was shortly forbidden to attempt it. I was ordered to care for your soul and see that you weren't corrupted by Yasna's teachings, and perhaps try to reclaim Yasna's soul as well.
Well, that last one is going to be difficult.
I hadn't noticed, he replied dryly.
She smiled, though she couldn't quite decide how to feel.
I kind of killed the moment, didn't I, between us?
I'm glad you did, he said, dusting off his hands. I get carried away, Shallan. At times I wonder if I'm as bad at being an Ardent as you are at being proper. I don't want to be presumptuous. It's just that the way you speak, it gets my mind churning and my tongue starts saying whatever comes to it.
And so we should call it a day, Capsule said, standing. I need time to think.
Shallan stood as well, holding out her free hand for his assistance. Standing up in a sleek Vorin dress was difficult. They were in a section of the gardens where the shale bark wasn't quite so high, so once standing, Shallan could see that the king himself was passing nearby, chatting with a middle-aged Ardent who had a long, narrow face. The king often went strolling through the gardens on his midday walk. She waved to him, but the kindly man didn't see her. He was deep in conversation with the Ardent. Capsule turned, noticed the king, then ducked down.
What? Shallan said.
The king keeps careful track of his Ardents. He and brother Ixil think I'm on cataloging duty today.
She found herself smiling. You're scrapping your day's work to go on a picnic with me?
Yes.
I thought you were supposed to spend time with me, she said, folding her arms. To protect my soul.
I was. But there are those among the Ardents who worry that I'm a little too interested in you.
They're right.
I'll come see you tomorrow, he said, peeking up over the top of the shale bark. Assuming I'm not stuck in indexing all day as a punishment.
He smiled at her.
If I decide to leave the Ardentia, that is my choice, and they cannot forbid it, though they may try to distract me.
He scrambled away as she prepared herself to tell him that he was presuming too much. She couldn't get the words out. Perhaps because she was growing less and less certain what she wanted. Shouldn't she be focused on helping her family? By now, Jasnah likely had discovered that her soul caster didn't work, but saw no advantage in revealing it. Shallan should leave. She could go to Jasnah and use the terrible experience in the alleyway as an excuse to quit. And yet she was terribly reluctant. Capsule was part of that, but he wasn't the main reason. The truth was that despite her occasional complaints, she loved learning to be a scholar. Even after Jasnah's philosophical training, even after spending days reading book after book, even with the confusion and the stress, Shallan often felt fulfilled in a way she'd never been before. Yes, Jasnah had been wrong to kill those men, but Shallan wanted to know enough about philosophy to cite the correct reasons why. Yes, digging through historical records could be tedious, but Shallan appreciated the skills and patience she was learning. They were sure to be of value when she got to do her own deep research in the future. Days spent learning, lunches spent laughing with Capsule, evenings chatting and debating with Jasnah. That was what she wanted, and those were the parts of her life that were complete lies. Troubled, she picked up the basket of bread and jam, then made her way back to the conclave and Jasnah's suite. An envelope addressed to her sat in the waiting bin. Shallan frowned, breaking the seal to look inside.
"Lass," it read, "we got your message. The Wind's Pleasure will soon be at port in Carbranth again. Of course we'll give you passage and return to your estates. It would be my pleasure to have you aboard. We are Davar men, we are. Indebted to your family. We're making a quick trip over to the mainland, but we'll hurry to Carbranth next. Expect us in 1 week's time to pick you up. Captain Tosbeck."
The undertext, written by Tosbeck's wife, read even more clearly. "We'd happily give you free passage, Brightness, if you're willing to do some scribing for us during the trip. The ledgers badly need to be rewritten." Shallan stared at the note for a long time. She'd wanted to know where he was and when he was planning to return, but he'd apparently taken her letter as a request to come and pick her up. It seemed a fitting deadline. That would put her departure at 3 weeks after stealing the soul caster, as she'd told Nan Balat to expect. If Jasnah hadn't reacted to the soul caster switch by then, Shallan would have to take it to mean that she wasn't under suspicion. 1 week. She would be on that ship.
It made her break inside to realize it, but it had to be done. She lowered the paper and left the guest hallway, her steps taking her through the twisting corridors into the veil. Shortly, she stood outside Yasna's alcove. The princess sat at her desk, reed scratching at a notebook. She glanced up.
I thought I told you that you could do whatever you want today.
You did, Shallan said. And I realized that what I want to do is study.
Yasna smiled in a sly, understanding way, almost a self-satisfied way, if she only knew.
Well, I'm not going to chide you for that, Yasna said, turning back to her research.
Shallan sat, offering the bread and jam to Yasna, who shook her head and continued researching. Shallan cut herself another slice and topped it with jam. Then she opened a book and sighed in satisfaction. In 1 week, she'd have to leave. But in the meantime, she would let herself pretend a little while longer.
The Wretch. They lived out in the wilds, always awaiting the desolation, or sometimes a foolish child who took no heed of the night's darkness. A child's tale, yes, but this quote from Shadows Remembered seems to hint at the truth I seek. See page 82, the fourth tale. Kaladin awoke to a familiar feeling of dread. He'd spent much of the night lying awake on the hard floor, staring up into the dark, thinking. Why try? Why care? There is no hope for these men. He felt like a wanderer, seeking desperately for a pathway into the city to escape wild beasts. But the city was atop a steep mountain, and no matter how he approached, the climb was always the same. Impossible. 100 different paths, the same result. Surviving his punishment would not save his men. Training them to run faster would not save them. They were bait. The efficiency of the bait did not change its purpose or its fate. Kaladin forced himself to his feet. He felt ground down, like a millstone used far too long. He still didn't understand how he'd survived. Did you preserve me, Almighty? Save me so that I could watch them die? You were supposed to burn prayers to send them to the Almighty, who waited for his heralds to recapture the Tranquiline Halls. That had never made sense to Kaladin. The Almighty was supposed to be able to see all and know all. So why did he need a prayer burned before he would do anything? Why did he need people to fight for him in the first place? Kaladin left the barrack, stepping into the light. Then he froze. The men were lined up, waiting. A ragged bunch of bridgemen, wearing brown leather vests and short trousers that only reached their knees. Dirty shirts, sleeves rolled down to the elbows, lacing down the front. Dusty skin, mops of ragged hair. And yet now, because of Rock's gift, they all had neatly trimmed beards or clean-shaven faces. Everything else about them was worn, but their faces were clean. Kaladin raised a hesitant hand to his face, touching his unkempt black beard. The men seemed to be waiting for something. What? He asked. The men shifted uncomfortably, glancing toward the lumberyard. They were waiting for him to lead them in practice, of course. But practice was futile. He opened his mouth to tell them that, but hesitated as he saw something approaching. 4 men, carrying a palanquin. A tall, thin man in a violet light-eyes coat walked beside it. The men turned to look. What's this? Haber asked, scratching at his thick neck. It will be Lamoral's replacement, Kaladin said, gently pushing his way through the line of bridgemen. Syl flitted down and landed on his shoulder as the palanquin bearers stopped before Kaladin and turned to the side, revealing a dark-haired woman wearing a sleek violet dress decorated with golden glyphs. She lounged on her side, resting on a cushioned couch, her eyes a pale blue. I am Brightness Hashal, she said, voice lightly touched by a Kolinar accent. My husband, Bright Lord Matal, is your new captain. Kaladin held his tongue, biting back a remark. He had some experience with Light Eyes who got promoted to positions like this one. Matal himself said nothing, simply standing with his hand resting on the hilt of his sword. He was tall, nearly as tall as Kaladin, but spindly, delicate hands. That sword hadn't seen much practice. We have been advised, Hashal said, that this crew has been troublesome. Her eyes narrowed, focusing on Kaladin. It seems that you have survived the Almighty's judgment. I bear a message for you from your betters. The Almighty has given you another chance to prove yourself as a bridgeman. That is all. Many are trying to read too much into what happened, so High Prince Satius has forbidden gawkers to come see you. My husband does not intend to run the bridge cruise with his predecessor's laxness. My husband is a well-respected and honored associate of High Prince Satius himself, not some near dark-eyed mongrel like Lamoral. Is that so? Kaladin said. Then how did he end up in this latrine pit of a job? Hashal didn't display a hint of anger at the comment. She flicked her fingers to the side, and one of the soldiers stepped forward and rammed the butt of his spear toward Kaladin's stomach. Kaladin caught it, old reflexes still too keen. Possibilities flashed through his mind, and he could see the fight before it took place. Yank on the spear, throw the soldier off guard. Step forward and ram an elbow into his forearm, making him drop the weapon. Take control, spin the spear up, and slam the soldier on the side of the head. Spin into a sweep to drop the two who came to help their companion. Raise the spear for the... No. That would only get Kaladin killed. Kaladin released the butt of the spear. The soldier blinked in surprise that a mere bridgeman had blocked his blow. Scowling, the soldier jerked the butt up and slammed it into the side of Kaladin's head. Kaladin let it hit him, rolling with it, allowing it to toss him to the ground. His head rang from the shock, but his eyesight stopped spinning after a moment. He'd have a headache, but probably no concussion. He took in a few deep breaths, lying on the ground, hands forming into fists. His fingers seemed to burn where he had touched the spear. The soldier stepped back into position beside the palanquin. No laxness, Hashal said calmly. If you must know, my husband requested this assignment. The bridge crews are essential to Bright Lord Satius's advantage in the War of Reckoning. Their mismanagement under Lamoral was disgraceful. Rock knelt down, helping Kaladin to his feet while scowling at the Light Eyes and their soldiers. Kaladin stumbled up, holding his hand to the side of his head. His fingers felt slick and wet, and a trickle of warm blood ran down his neck to his shoulder. From now on, Hashal said, aside from doing normal bridge duty, each crew will be assigned only one type of work duty. Gaz? The short bridge sergeant poked out from behind the palanquin. Kaladin hadn't noticed him there, behind the porters and the soldiers. Yes, Brightness? Gaz bowed several times. My husband wishes Bridge 4 to be assigned chasm duty permanently. Whenever they are not needed for bridge duty, I want them working in those chasms. This will be far more efficient. They will know which sections have been scoured recently and will not cover the same ground. You see? Efficiency. They will start immediately. She rapped on the side of her palanquin, and the porters turned, bearing her away. Her husband continued to walk alongside her without saying a word, and Gaz hurried to keep up. Kaladin stared after them, holding his hand to his head. Dunny ran and fetched him a bandage. Chasm duty, Moash grumbled. Great job, lordling. She'd see us dead from a chasm fiend if the Parshendi arrows don't take us. What are we going to do? Asked lean, balding Pete. His voice edged with worry. We get to work, Kaladin said, taking the bandage from Dunny. He walked away, leaving them in a frightened clump. A short time later, Kaladin stood at the edge of the chasm looking down. The hot light of the noon sun burned the back of his neck and cast his shadow downward into the rift to join with those below. I could fly, he thought. Step off and fall, wind blowing against me. Fly for a few moments, a few beautiful moments. He knelt and grabbed the rope ladder, then climbed down into the darkness. The other bridgemen followed in a silent group. They'd been infected by his mood. Kaladin knew what was happening to him. Step by step, he was turning back into the wretch he had been. He'd always known it was a danger. He'd clung to the bridgeman as a lifeline, but he was letting go now. As he stepped down the rungs, a faint translucent figure of blue and white dropped beside him, sitting on a swing-like seat. Its ropes disappeared a few inches above Syl's head.
"What's wrong with you?" she asked softly.
Kaladin just kept climbing down.
"You should be happy. You survived the storms. The other bridgemen were so excited."
"I itched to fight that soldier," Kaladin whispered. Syl cocked her head. "I could have beaten him," Kaladin continued. "I probably could have beaten all four of them. I've always been good with the spear. No, not good. Dirk called me amazing. A natural-born soldier. An artist with the spear."
"Maybe you should have fought them then."
"I thought you didn't like killing."
"I hate it," she said,
growing more translucent.
"But I've helped men kill before."
Kaladin froze on the ladder.
"What?" "It's true," she said. "I can remember it, just faintly."
"How?"
"I don't know."
She grew paler.
"I don't want to talk about it, but it was right to do. I feel it."
Kaladin hung for a moment longer. Teft called down, asking if something was wrong. He started to descend again. "I didn't fight the soldiers today," Kaladin said, eyes toward the chasm wall, "because it wouldn't work. My father told me that it is impossible to protect by killing." "Well, he was wrong."
"But..."
"He was wrong," Kaladin said, "because he implied that you could protect people in other ways. You can't. This world wants them dead, and trying to save them is pointless." He reached the bottom of the chasm, stepping into darkness. Teft reached the bottom next and lit his torch, bathing the moss-covered stone walls in flickering orange light.
"Is that why you didn't accept it?"
Syl whispered, flitting over and landing on Kaladin's shoulder.
"The glory? All those months ago?"
Kaladin shook his head. "No. That was something else."
"What did you say, Kaladin?"
Teft raised the torch. The aging bridgeman's face looked older than usual in the flickering light, the shadows it created emphasizing the furrows in his skin. "Nothing, Teft," Kaladin said. "Nothing important." Syl sniffed at that. Kaladin ignored her, lighting his torch from Teft's as the other bridgeman arrived. When they were all down, Kaladin led the way out into the dark rift. The pale sky seemed distant here, like a far-off scream. This place was a tomb, with rotting wood and stagnant pools of water, good only for growing kremling larvae. The bridgemen clustered together unconsciously, as they always did in this fell place. Kaladin walked in front, and Syl fell silent. He gave Teft the chalk to mark directions and didn't pause to pick up salvage, but neither did he walk too quickly. The other bridgemen were hushed behind them, speaking in occasional whispers too low to echo, as if their words were strangled by the gloom. Rock eventually moved up to walk beside Kaladin.
"It's a difficult job we have been given. But we are bridgemen. Life is difficult, eh? There's nothing new. We must have plan. How do we fight next?"
"There is no next fight, Rock."
"But we have won grand victory. Look, not days ago you were delirious, You should have died. I know this thing. But instead you walk, strong as any other man. Ha! Stronger! Is miracle. The Ulitekanaki guide you.
It's not a miracle, Rock, Kaladin said. It's more of a curse.
How is that a curse, my friend?
Rock asked, chuckling. He jumped up and into a puddle, and laughed louder as it splashed Teft, who was walking just behind. The large horn-eater could be remarkably childlike at times.
Living. This thing is no curse.
It is if it brings me back to watch you all die, Kaladin said. Better I shouldn't have survived that storm. I'm just going to end up dead from a Parshendi arrow. We all are. Rock looked troubled. When Kaladin offered nothing more, he withdrew. They continued, uncomfortably passing sections of scarred wall where chasm fiends had left their marks. Eventually, they stumbled across a heap of bodies deposited by the high storms. Kaladin stopped, holding up his torch, the other bridgemen peeking around him. Some 50 people had been washed into a recess in the rock, a small dead-end side passage in the stone. The bodies were piled there, a wall of the dead, arms hanging out, reeds and flotsam stuck between them. Kaladin saw at a glance that the corpses were old enough to begin bloating and rotting. Behind him, one of the men retched, which caused a few of the others to do so as well. The scent was terrible, the corpses slashed and ripped into by kremlings and larger carrion beasts, many of which scuttled away from the light. A disembodied hand lay nearby, and a trail of blood led away. There were also fresh scrapes in the lichen as high as 15 feet up the wall. A chasm fiend had ripped one of the bodies loose to devour. It might come back for the others. Kaladin didn't retch. He shoved his half-burnt torch between two large stones, then got to work, pulling bodies from the pile. At least they weren't rotted enough to come apart. The bridgemen slowly filled in around him, working. Kaladin let his mind grow numb, not thinking. Once the bodies were down, the bridgemen laid them in a line. Then they began pulling off their armor, searching their pockets, taking knives from belts. Kaladin left gathering the spears to the others, working by himself off to the side. Teft knelt beside Kaladin, rolling over a body with a head smashed by the fall. The shorter man began to undo the straps on the fallen man's breastplate.
Do you want to talk?
Kaladin didn't say anything. He just kept working. Don't think about the future. Don't think about what will happen. Just survive. Don't care, but don't despair. Just be.
Kaladin!
Teft's voice was like a knife, digging into Kaladin's shell, making him squirm.
If I wanted to talk, Kaladin grumbled, would I be working here by myself?
Fair enough, Teft said. He finally got the breastplate strap undone.
The other men are confused, son. They want to know what we're going to do next.
Kaladin sighed, then stood, turning to look at the bridgemen.
I don't know what to do. If we try to protect ourselves, Sadius will have us punished. We're bait, and we're going to die. There's nothing I can do about it. It's hopeless.
The bridgemen regarded him with shock. Kaladin turned from them and went back to work, kneeling beside Teft.
There, he said. I explained it to them.
Idiot, Teft said under his breath. After all you've done, you're abandoning us now?
To the side, the bridgemen turned back to work. Kaladin caught a few of them grumbling.
Bastard, Moash said. I said this would happen.
Abandoning you? Kaladin hissed to Teft.
Just let me be. Let me go back to apathy. At least then there's no pain.
Teft, I've spent hours and hours trying to find a way out, but there isn't one. Sadius wants us dead. Light eyes get what they want. That's the way the world works.
So?
Kaladin ignored him, turning back to his work.
pulling at the boot on a soldier whose fibula looked to have been shattered in 3 different places. That made it storming awkward to get the boot off.
"Well, maybe we will die," Teft said. "But maybe this isn't about surviving."
Why was Teft, of all people, trying to cheer him up?
"If survival isn't the point, Teft, then what is?"
Kaladin finally got the boot off. He turned to the next body in line, then froze. It was a bridgeman. Kaladin didn't recognize him, but that vest and those sandals were unmistakable. He lay slumped against the wall, arms at his sides, mouth slightly open and eyelids sunken. The skin on one of the hands had slipped free and pulled away.
"I don't know what the point is," Teft grumbled. "But it seems pathetic to give up. We should keep fighting, right until those arrows take us. You know, journey before destination."
"What does that mean?"
"I don't know," Teft said, looking down quickly. "Just something I heard once."
"It's something the Lost Radiance used to say," Sigzel said, walking past. Kaladin glanced to the side. The soft-spoken Azish man set a shield on a pile. He looked up, brown skin dark in the torchlight. It was their motto. Part of it, at least. Life before death. Strength before weakness. Journey before destination.
"Lost Radiance?" Scar said, carrying an armful of boots. "Who's bringing them up?"
"Teft did," Moash said.
"I did not. That was just something I heard once."
"What does it even mean?" Dunny asked.
"I said I don't know," Teft said.
"It was supposedly one of their creeds," Sigzel said. "In Yule, there are groups of people who talk of the Radiance and wish for their return."
"Who'd want them to return?" Scar said, leaning back against the wall, folding his arms. "They betrayed us to the Voidbringers."
"Ha," Rock said. "Voidbringers. Lowlander nonsense. Is campfire tale told by children."
"They were real," Scar said defensively. "Everyone knows that."
"Everyone who listens to campfire stories," Rock said with a laugh. "Too much air. Makes your mind soft. Is all right, though. You are still my family. Just the dumb ones."
Teft scowled as the others continued to talk about the Lost Radiance.
"Journey before destination," Syl whispered on Kaladin's shoulder. "I like that."
"Why?" Kaladin asked, kneeling down to untie the dead bridgeman's sandals.
"Because,"
she replied, as if that were explanation enough.
"Teft is right, Kaladin. I know you want to give up, but you can't."
"Why not?"
"Because you can't."
"We're assigned to chasm duty from now on," Kaladin said. "We won't be able to collect any more reeds to make money. That means no more bandages, antiseptic, or food for the nightly meals. With all of these bodies, we're bound to run into Rotspren, and the men will grow sick, assuming chasm fiends don't eat us or a surprise high storm doesn't drown us. And we'll have to keep running those bridges until damnation ends, losing man after man. It's hopeless."
The men were still talking.
"The Lost Radiance helped the other side," Scar argued. "They were tarnished all along."
Teft took offense at that. The wiry man stood up straight, pointing at Scar.
"You don't know anything. It was too long ago. Nobody knows what really happened."
"Then why do all the stories say the same thing?" Scar demanded. "They abandon us. Just like the Light Eyes are abandoning us now. Maybe Kaladin's right. Maybe there is no hope."
Kaladin looked down. Those words haunted him. Maybe Kaladin is right. Maybe there is no hope. He'd done this before. Under his last owner, before being sold to Dvlakov and being made a bridgeman.
He'd given up on a quiet night after leading Goshal and the other slaves in rebellion. They'd been slaughtered. But somehow he'd survived.
Storm and all, why did he always survive? I can't do it again, he thought, squeezing his eyes shut. I can't help them. Tian, Tux, Goshal, Dalit. The nameless slave he'd tried to heal into Vlokov's slave wagons. All had ended up the same. Kaladin had the touch of failure. Sometimes he gave them hope, but what was hope except another opportunity for failure? How many times could a man fall before he no longer stood back up?
I just think we're ignorant, Teft grumbled. I don't like listening to what the Light Eyes say about the past. Their women write all the histories, you know.
I can't believe you're arguing about this, Teft, Scar said, exasperated. What next? Should we let the Voidbringers steal our hearts? Maybe they're just misunderstood. Or the Parshendi? Maybe we should just let them kill our king whenever they want.
Would you two just storm off? Moash snapped. It doesn't matter. You heard Kaladin. Even he thinks we're as good as dead.
Kaladin couldn't take their voices anymore. He stumbled away into the darkness, away from the torchlight. None of the men followed him. He entered a place of dark shadows, with only the distant ribbon of sky above for light. Here, Kaladin escaped their eyes. In the darkness, he ran into a boulder, stumbling to a stop. It was slick with moss and lichen. He stood with his hands pressed against it, then groaned and turned around to lean back against it. Syl alighted in front of him, still visible despite the darkness. She sat down in the air, arranging her dress around her legs.
I can't save them, Syl, Kaladin whispered, anguished.
Are you certain?
I've failed every time before.
And so you'll fail this time, too?
Yes.
She fell silent.
Well, then,
she eventually said,
let's say that you're right.
So why fight? I told myself that I would try one last time, but I failed before I began. There's no saving them.
Doesn't the fight itself mean anything?
Not if you're destined to die.
He hung his head. Sigzil's words echoed in his head. Life before death. Strength before weakness. Journey before destination. Kaladin looked up at the crack of sky, like a faraway river of pure blue water. Life before death. What did the saying mean? That men should seek life before seeking death? That was obvious. Or did it mean something else? That life came before death? Again, obvious. And yet the simple words spoke to him. Death comes, they whispered. Death comes to all. But life comes first. Cherish it. Death is the destination, but the journey, that is life. That is what matters. A cold wind blew through the corridor of stone, washing over him, bringing crisp, fresh scents and blowing away the stink of rotting corpses. Nobody cared for the bridgemen. Nobody cared for those at the bottom with the darkest eyes. And yet that wind seemed to whisper to him over and over. Life before death. Life before death. Live before you die. His foot hit something. He bent down and picked it up. A small rock. He could barely make it out in the darkness. He recognized what was happening to him, this melancholy, this sense of despair. It had taken him often when he'd been younger, most frequently during the weeks of the weeping, when the sky was hidden by clouds. During those times, Tian had cheered him up, helped him pull out of his despair. Tian had always been able to do that. Once he'd lost his brother, he'd dealt with these periods of sadness more awkwardly. He'd become the wretch, not caring,
but also not despairing. It had seemed better not to feel at all, as opposed to feeling pain.
I'm going to fail them, Kaladin thought, squeezing his eyes shut. Why try?
Wasn't he a fool to keep grasping as he did? If only he could win once. That would be enough. As long as he could believe that he could help someone, as long as he believed that some paths led to places other than darkness, he could hope.
You promised yourself you would try one last time, he thought. They aren't dead yet. Still alive. For now.
There was one thing he hadn't tried. Something he'd been too frightened of. Every time he'd tried it in the past, he'd lost everything. The wretch seemed to be standing before him. He meant release. Apathy. Did Kaladin really want to go back to that? It was a false refuge. Being that man hadn't protected him. It had only led him deeper and deeper until taking his own life had seemed the better way. Life before death. Kaladin stood up, opening his eyes, dropping the small rock. He walked slowly back toward the torchlight. The bridgemen looked up from their work. So many questioning eyes. Some doubtful, some grim, others encouraging. Rock, Dunny, Hobber, Layton. They believed in him. He had survived the storms. One miracle granted.
There is something we could try, Kaladin said. But it will most likely end with all of us dead at the hands of our own army.
We're bound to end up dead anyway, Maps noted. You said so yourself.
Several of the others nodded. Kaladin took a deep breath.
We have to try to escape.
But the war camp is guarded, said Earless Jax. Bridgemen aren't allowed out without supervision. They know we'd run.
We'd die, Moash said, face grim. We're miles and miles from civilization. There's nothing out here but great shells, and no shelter from high storms.
I know, Kaladin said. But it's either this or the Parshendi arrows.
The men fell silent.
They're going to send us down here every day to rob corpses, Kaladin said. And they don't send us with supervision, since they fear the chasm fiends. Most bridgemen work as busy work, to distract us from our fate. So we only have to bring back a small amount of salvage.
You think we should choose one of these chasms and flee down it? Scar asked. They've tried to map them all. The crews never reached the other side of the plains. They got killed by chasm fiends or high storm floods.
Kaladin shook his head. That's not what we're going to do.
He kicked at something on the ground before him. A fallen spear. His kick sent it into the air toward Moash, who caught it, surprised.
I can train you to use those, Kaladin said softly.
The men fell silent, looking at the weapon.
What good would this thing do? Rock asked,
taking the spear from Moash, looking it over.
We cannot fight an army.
No, Kaladin said. But if I train you, then we can attack a guard post at night. We might be able to get away.
Kaladin looked at them, meeting each man's eyes in turn.
Once we're free, they'll send soldiers after us. Sadeus won't let Bridgman kill his soldiers and get away with it. We'll have to hope he underestimates us and sends a small group at first. If we kill them, we might be able to get far enough away to hide. It will be dangerous. Sadeus will go to great lengths to recapture us, and will likely end with an entire company chasing us down. Stormont will probably never escape the camp in the first place. But it's something.
He fell silent, waiting as the men exchanged uncertain glances.
I'll do it, Teft said, straightening up.
Me too,
Moash said, stepping forward. He seemed eager.
And I, Sigzil said. I would rather spit in their Alethi faces and die on their swords than remain a slave.
Ha! Rock said. And I shall cook you all much food to keep you full while you kill.
You won't fight with us? Dunny asked, surprised.
Is beneath me, Rock said, raising his chin.
Well, I'll do it, Dunny said. I'm your man, Captain.
Others began to chime in, each man standing, several grabbing spears from the wet ground. They didn't yell in excitement or roar like other troops Kaladin had led. They were frightened by the idea of fighting. Most had been common slaves or lowly workmen. But they were willing. Kaladin stepped forward and began to outline a plan. The history of man. The expulsion. The loss of the Tranquiline Halls. The desolations. War against the Voidbringers. Aharyat Yam. The last desolation. Defeat of the Voidbringers. The Recreants. The fall of the Knights Radiant. The Hierocracy. The failure of Vornism. Forty-four. The Weeping. 5 years ago. Kaladin hated the Weeping. It marked the end of an old year and the coming of a new one. 4 solid weeks of rain in a ceaseless cascade of sullen drops. Never furious, never passionate like a high storm. Slow, steady. Like the blood of a dying year that was taking its last few shambling steps toward the cairn. While other seasons of weather came and went unpredictably, the Weeping never failed to return at the same time each year. Unfortunately. Kaladin lay on the sloped roof of his house and hearthstone. A small pail of pitch sat next to him, covered by a piece of wood. It was almost empty now that he'd finished patching the roof. The Weeping was a miserable time to do this work, but it was also when a persistent leak could be most irritating. They'd repatch when the Weeping ended, but at least this way they wouldn't have to suffer a steady stream of drops onto their dining table for the next weeks. He lay on his back, staring up at the sky. Perhaps he should have climbed down and gone inside, but he was already soaked through, so he stayed. Watching. Thinking. Another army was passing through the town. One of many these days. They often came during the Weeping, resupplying and moving to new battlefields. Rishon had made a rare appearance to welcome the warlord. High Marshal Amaram himself, apparently a distant cousin as well as head of Alethi defense in this area. He was of the most renowned soldiers still in Alethkar. Most had left for the Shattered Plains. The small raindrops misted Kaladin. Many of the others liked these weeks. There were no high storms, save for one right in the middle. To the townspeople, it was a cherished time to rest from farming and relax. But Kaladin longed for the sun and the wind. He actually missed the high storms, with their rage and vitality. These days were dreary, and he found it difficult to get anything productive done, as if the lack of storms left him without strength. Few people had seen much of Rishon since the ill-fated Whitespine hunt and the death of his son. He hid in his mansion, increasingly reclusive. The people of Hearthstone trod very lightly, as if they expected that any moment he could explode and turn his rage against them. Kaladin wasn't worried about that. A storm, whether from a person or the sky, was something you could react to. But this suffocation, this slow and steady dousing of life? That was far, far worse. Kaladin? Tian's voice called. Are you still up there? Yeah, he called back, not moving. The clouds were so bland during the Weeping. Could anything be more lifeless than that miserable gray? Tian rounded to the back of the building, where the roof sloped down to touch the ground. He had his hands in the pockets of his long raincoat, a wide-brimmed hat on his head. Both looked too large for him,
but clothing always seemed too large for Tien, even when it fit him properly. Kaladin's brother climbed up onto the roof and walked up beside him, then lay down, staring upward. Someone else might have tried to cheer Kaladin up, and they would have failed. But somehow Tien knew the right thing to do. For the moment, that was keeping silent. "You like the rain, don't you?" Kaladin finally asked him.
"Yeah,"
Tien said. Of course, Tien liked pretty much everything.
"Hard to stare up at it like this, though. I keep blinking."
For some reason, that made Kaladin smile.
"I made you something," Tien said. "At the shop today."
Kaladin's parents were worried. Ral, the carpenter, had taken Tien, though he didn't really need another apprentice, and was reportedly dissatisfied with the boy's work. Tien got distracted easily, Ral complained. Kaladin sat up as Tien fished something out of his pocket. It was a small wooden horse, intricately carved.
"Don't worry about the water," Tien said, handing it over. "I sealed it already."
"Tien," Kaladin said, amazed. "This is beautiful." The details were amazing. The eyes, the hooves, the lines in the tail. It looked just like the majestic animals that pulled Rishon's carriage.
"Did you show this to Ral?"
"He said it was good," Tien said, smiling beneath his oversized hat. "But he told me I should have been making a chair instead. I kind of got into trouble."
"But how... I mean, Tien, he's gotta see this is amazing."
"Oh, I don't know about that," Tien said, still smiling. "It's just a horse. Master Ral likes things you can use. Things to sit on, things to put clothes in. But I think I can make a good chair tomorrow. Something that will make him proud."